Support for Ben Franklin's World and the Doing History to the Revolution series comes from the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture.
I think the American Revolution is certainly a transformative moment in which a place goes from being a colony with competing empires, indigenous and British, to an independent nation with many competing nations within it, being separate.
The American Revolution, well, obviously, it is the founding moment of the United States, and that's a really important part of it. And I think the founding of the United States is itself revolutionary. But the American Revolution also marks a new moment in popular government. And so it's also about allowing new people into the story of how we're going to govern ourselves. So it's at least two revolutions, maybe more.
I think that the revolution was an opportunity for a lot of different people to make changes in their lives. Some of them did it for ideological reasons, but some of them took advantage of a chaotic situation to change their situation.
The American Revolution from Indian country is the breaking of institutional shackles by colonists and then the creation of new ones for slaves and American Indians.
The American Revolution was, on one hand, the military conflict that resulted in the political separation of America from Britain, but in a larger sense, it was a moment that marked a rupture between certain commercial and political and economic practices of the 18th century that opened up a bridge towards the economic development and political development of the 19th century. That's a hard question.
What do we mean by the American Revolution? How do we define it? Was it a war? Was it a social movement, a political movement, or an economic movement? When did the American Revolution begin? Was it as John Adams suggested to Hezekiah Niles in February 1818 that the revolution was effected before the war commenced? That the revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people? It turns out, defining the revolution is a difficult task. And if you ask a lot of different historians to define what the American Revolution was, as I did at the Omohundro Institute's annual conference in June, well, you'll get a lot of different answers to the question.
The American Revolution was a whole combination, a whole series, a whole conjury of events and rebellions that happened in what became the United States, as well as the Caribbean and the Atlantic and around the world in the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s that resulted in the birth of the United States.
I think it's a social and political movement to form a republic that sought to redress some of the grievances they saw in the British Empire, but retain much of the same economic, and in a lot of ways, much of the same political system as well.
The American Revolution was the moment when British colonials in the American colonies organized, rather organically, a series of protests that turned into a great war.
The American Revolution is a moment of great upheaval in the 1770s and 1780s that eventually ends up creating a nation and moreover opens up all kinds of new ideas about the ways in which people can be part of a national and an international world.
The American Revolution was an event by which the British colonies and the imperial government strongly disagreed over the proper way to run the empire, largely failed to come to an agreement, and through a combination of events to do with global trade, religion, and national politics in the colonies came to a significant break, which led to years and years of war and the creation of a brand new nation.
Welcome to Ben Franklin's World, a podcast about early American history with Liz Covart. The study of history is key to understanding who we are and how we can affect a better future. Ben Franklin's World will introduce you to historical people and events that have impacted and shaped our present-day world. And now, here's your host, Liz Covart.
Hello, and welcome to the Doing History to the Revolution series on Ben Franklin's World. The Doing History to the Revolution series aims to explore not just the history of the American Revolution, but the histories of the American Revolution. Which means we'll not only explore topics such as what caused the American Revolution, how the Patriots assumed governance over the 13 colonies, and how the Continental Congress and Continental Army executed the War for Independence. We'll also explore how what we know about the American Revolution has changed over time. This episode, episode 151, kicks off this series with an exploration of how we define the American Revolution. And as you just heard, there are a lot of different answers to that question. So we're going to explore a case study of how a historian who was asked to define and explain the American Revolution to a really large group of people, did so. We're going to go behind the scenes of the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. Philip Mead is the historian and curator of the Museum of the American Revolution. Since 2011, Phil has been advising the museum on how to curate exhibits that convey the dynamic story of the revolution using revolutionary-era weapons, personal items, documents, and works of art, as well as modern-day immersive galleries, dynamic theaters, and recreated historical environments. Phil and his colleagues definitely had a tough job. They had to answer the question of, how do you define and tell the story of the American Revolution, given its large scope and complexity, and given the fact that you don't have infinite amounts of space to do so? Now, grappling with this question also means that Phil and his colleagues had to answer other questions, such as, what stories and aspects of the American Revolution do you include in the museum's story and interpretation of it? Do you favor protests and other political actions over the military actions that secured independence? And how do you balance the revolution's military and non-military aspects? These are questions we're going to ask Phil during our conversation about the museum and what we mean by the American Revolution. So with that introduction in place, are you ready to meet Phil and venture into the history of the American Revolution? Off to the revolution we go. Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today and for taking us behind the scenes of the Museum of the American Revolution. Now, as you know, we're really curious about how you and your colleagues grappled with that huge question of how do you define the American Revolution? But before we get into that, would you tell us how the Museum of the American Revolution came to be? Why was the museum created?
That gets sort of into the question of who created it and when. And as any historian will tell you, you can start any given story from a variety of different points. So in some ways, this is a 100-year-old project. In some ways, it's a 20-year-old project. The museum began at the turn of the 20th to 21st century as a evolution from the old Valley Forge Historical Society, which was a private museum out by Valley Forge National Historical Park. That historical society shared space with a chapel, which was an active church, and the church was expanding, and the historical society offered to gift or donate the collection to anyone who could find a new home and new public museum venue for it. And so the project began really as an effort to find a home for a collection. And the collection was really very significant. It was about 3,000 objects. It included things like one of the muskets of the 4th Regiment of Foot that was at the Battle of Lexington at Concord. It was actually at Concord Bridge. It included Washington's own office and sleeping tent that he used from 1778 until 1783 as his private quarters. So it evolved from there. And when the project began, there was no National Museum of the American Revolution. And there were a lot of museums that focused on Revolutionary War battles or personalities or major political statements, the declarations, the constitutions, even pamphlet writers like Thomas Paine. But there seemed to be a need for some place where people could see how it fits together and learn more about aspects of the revolution that might be in other regions or even other parts of the world and how they fit into the narrative. And so it took 17 years, but the museum that's here in Philadelphia aims to fulfill that mission.
So what exactly will we see when we come to visit the museum? How is the museum laid out and what types of exhibits does it have?
Well, the museum is on 3rd and Chestnut Street in Old City, Philadelphia. It sits directly across from the first national bank, Hamilton's Bank, and it is a stone's throw from Independence Hall. It's 118,000 square feet, 4 floors. Upstairs, when you first come in, there's a theater that holds about 200 people, which shows our movie Revolution, that's its name, which is about a 15-minute film that tells the story arc from 1760 to 1790, and then talks about the ongoing revolution, just to give a kind of preparation or framework for the stories people will find on the second floor. After you're done with that intro film, you go up a large spiral staircase onto the second floor, and the staircase empties out toward a door that is the entrance to the main galleries. The main galleries are sort of horseshoe-shaped, and you enter them in a semicircular space where a projection of life-size figures tears down a equestrian statue of George III, recreating the scene of New York on July 9, 1776, right after the reading of the Declaration of Independence. That ends with a series of four questions which shape the content of the exhibits and are meant to sort of guide your thinking as you go through. We do questions because we want people to begin thinking about history as something that requires interpretation, that is still open for new discoveries or new thinking. And those questions are, how did people become revolutionaries? How did the revolution survive its darkest hour? How revolutionary was the war? And what kind of nation did the revolution create? So as you move through the first quarter of the galleries, we give you a lot of different ways of answering the question, how do people become revolutionaries? And we use lots of different storytelling methods, from big cases filled with significant artifacts. In the first gallery, you see a large case with objects that have royal iconography on them. All of these are objects made or used in America that signal Americans' devotion to the British monarch prior to the revolution, and show how surprising it would have been to know at, say, 1760, that little over 15 years from then, there'd be an independence movement of real consequence. And these are everyday items. They're tavern mugs and pieces of fireplaces, clocks, little document boxes, paintings and powder horns. And then we also use theater pieces, short movies, many of which we call object theaters. They integrate the objects into the telling of the story. So you see the object that's actually in front of you in a case come across the screen as it becomes an actor, as it becomes important in the history we're talking about. Then we have big environmental experiences like the next room, which is called Resistance and tells the story from 1765 to 1775, centers on a reproduction of a Liberty Tree. And hanging from it are lanterns, recreating the scene in Boston after the repeal of the Stamp Act, when Sons and Daughters of Liberty hung lanterns from their own homes, one each to symbolize all the members of Parliament who had voted for repeal. And there's kind of a barn wall, which has an interactive where you can explore broadsides, kind of as if they were on that wall near the tree. There's also tactile elements for people who want to feel something, know what something in the past felt like. There's an area where you can explore and touch reproduction objects of goods that American colonists had access to from around the British Empire. There's actually a few historic items you can touch. They're embedded in the Liberty Tree, a real piece of wood from the last surviving real Liberty Tree, which fell in Annapolis, Maryland in 1999. And you're invited to touch a piece of history there and actually run your hand across that piece of the tree. Later, the exhibits continue using many of those same elements, those same combination of storytelling methods. As you move through to 1776, you confront a pillar with cases on either side of it. On the front are 1776 July printings of the Declaration of Independence. On the back are objects representing the religious diversity of early America and talking about the emerging concept of religious freedom. So one wall looks at the idea of equality at that time. One wall looks at the revolutionary state constitutions, some of the first written constitutions in the history of the world. And after you move past that material, you see in three dimensions our life-size reconstruction of the George III statue that we tore down in the first theater piece, and beneath it, original pieces of the statue itself. As you move past that, you enter the 1776 through 1778 part of the war. You encounter the second question, which is, how did the revolution survive its darkest hour? How did Americans before the alliances with the French and the Spanish allying with the French then and the British declaring war on the Dutch, how did the revolutionaries preserve their movement against the might of the British Empire? And there you see cases of a lot of military objects. You see maps put on the floors and walls. You see figures representing people from different communities at war. You experience different environments. There's recreation of the interior of the Pennsylvania State House, what's now called Independence Hall. But the scene you're looking at is not the signing of the Declaration or the Constitution, but the building as it appeared when the British occupied Philadelphia, and it became a barracks for British soldiers and a holding place for American prisoners of war. As you keep moving through, you see groups of furniture of the types confiscated from loyalists by revolutionary governments. You see furniture confiscated from Quakers for their neutral stance, their religious principles against fighting or financially supporting the war. And you encounter our third question of how revolutionary was the war. And there we really look at the social turmoil and disruption and changes and aspirations of particularly the later years of the Revolutionary War. And it's in that sequence where we show the war turning south. And there you encounter enslaved people in Virginia in 1781. You see them here again. We have one of our life-size tableau, and you see a teenaged African-American in a red coat speaking to two people of African descent working in a field. And you learn, as the words above the figures say, sometimes freedom wore a red coat. In the interactive display below that, you follow the stories, you choose different stories and follow them, of enslaved people who pursued a route to freedom through the British Army. The British, of course, having made offers of emancipation to the enslaved people of rebel masters who reached the British lines. And so you see narratives of real lives of people who had to make those tough calls of whether to trust that. And then in the final gallery on the war, you see the French alliance producing this huge army to move against Cornwallis at Yorktown with Washington and the victory at Yorktown. But then also half of that theater deals with the expansion and escalation of the war in the West, in the areas controlled and homelands of Native American people there, as both British and Americans looked to grab up Indian lands as spoils of war. And it's after that that you learn of the final Peace of Paris, and you get a fourth question, which is, what kind of nation did the revolution create? And in that gallery, we look at the unfinished victories of the war. Where do people like Phyllis Wheatley, the African-American poet from Boston, where is she by 1784? What is her life like? What is the world like for a man like Chainbreaker, Seneca, who fought alongside the British during the Revolutionary War? And you learn about the Shaysites or the Regulator movement trying to assert the rights of ordinary veterans and farmers, as well as the aspirations of statesmen like Benjamin Lincoln, who had fought as a general in the Revolutionary War and helped put the Shaysites down. You encounter, as the final large case, a collection of everyday objects now with Republican symbols on them, images of Washington and the chain of states that Franklin designed to represent the United States. You see eagles on neoclassical imagery of the Roman Republic. And that sort of bookends the first case filled with royal objects, so that you have kind of come full circle and are confronted with the question, how much really did change if these objects are pretty similar, but they have different symbols on them? And as you leave, as you say, you have an ongoing revolution theater experience that takes the story up through today, and you pass by a wall of photographs of members of the revolutionary generation who lived into the age of photography. And as you pass by those, you turn and there's a bank of mirrors that reflects your own image back to you, and it says, meet the future of the American Revolution. So the message is that while that generation has passed, the revolution and its ideas live on.
Okay, so now that we have a better understanding of the museum and its layout, let's dive into our exploration of how the curators and historians at the Museum of the American Revolution define and interpret the revolution. Phil, would you tell us about how the Museum of the American Revolution defines the revolution?
Sure. Well, about midway through the project, we actually convened a meeting to discuss what we mean by the American Revolution. And this is an old question. It's one that the revolutionaries themselves ask themselves. And we went back to try to find, you know, what the revolutionaries themselves said, and then how the revolution has been defined in the public, in memory, as well as scholarship over 240 years. And of course, what we immediately identified as a problem is that the one thing the revolutionaries seemed to agree on is that they couldn't agree when the time period began and ended, and that historians seem to have some of those same debates. So, you know, for example, John Adams in 1818 published an essay in Niles' Weekly Register saying that, what do we mean by the revolution? And he said, the revolution was effected before the war commenced. It was in the minds and hearts of the people. This is a kind of a familiar quote. Now, slightly lesser known quote comes from Benjamin Rush, who in 1787 wrote, there's nothing more common than to confound the terms of the American Revolution with those of the late American War. The American War is over, but this is far from being the case with the American Revolution. So you have Adams saying that the revolution was effected before the war, and Rush saying it's barely begun by the time the war is over. And then, you know, there are, I think, a lot of definitions of the revolution that are squarely about the war, that the revolution is often thought to be equivalent to the war. So for us, in the midst of this sort of churning and process, we really arrived at a few basic approaches. One is that there was more than one revolution in America in the late 18th century, that certainly the revolution that created the United States and that set it in motion as a nation dedicated to government as republics, government by a popular rule on some level, dedicated to certain principles of rights and liberties and aspirations of equality, has a major role in our narrative, but also there are other revolutions that intersect with that revolution that sometimes are moving in their own direction. Revolutions of people like enslaved people who find in, as we put it, wearing a red coat, a certain hope and aspiration of freedom. That is, by joining and assisting the British forces, they might obtain their physical, possibly even political freedom. So these are part of a common era in which social and political and cultural norms are shifting and changing, and it's not clear what kind of world will come out of it. So we wanted to keep hold of these multiple revolutions without overly synthesizing them, without overly equating them, but also telling them as part of a continuous narrative. And so the second proposition, if the first is that there's more than one revolution, is to tell a chronological story through the museum. That actually roughly runs along a fairly, I think, conventional periodization of a revolutionary era in American history. And ours roughly goes from 1760 to 1790. So the accession of George III to the throne of England, and then he's coronated in 1761 through to the sitting of the federal government in Philadelphia. And the third outcome of those meetings was that we would really highlight 1776 as a major turning point in the story of that revolution. And not just because it was the moment when Americans declared the independence of the United States, but because the language of the Declaration of Independence, by committing that country's existence and reason for being to certain positions about universal liberty that transcended the realities of the social world of 18th century America. By doing that, the revolution took, I think, a dramatically new turn, and one that is still being worked out and reshaped and evolving today. And so our final point, which is conveyed in our last piece in the galleries, a theater called Ongoing Revolution, says that in that sense, in the sense that these transcendent principles are still being worked out, the revolution is still going on. And so the periodization in that sense would have to go all the way up through today.
Phil, you hit this nail on its head. The idea of what the American Revolution was and when it began is a really fraught issue, not only with the people who lived through the revolution, but also with historians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you noted that the Museum of the American Revolution starts its interpretation and history of the revolution in 1760. And I wonder if you would tell us how you and the other historians and curators at the museum decided to start with that date.
Well, there were arguments to start it in 1775 with the outbreak of violence between the British forces and the New England Minutemen Militia that really began the war. But we wanted to make the point that the revolution and the war are not coextant, that the war was revolutionary in its impact, but the revolution isn't just the war. There was an argument to begin it in 1765. That's, of course, the Stamp Act year. And so there are many historians who have argued that that's the moment when Americans begin to really be conscious of a kind of separate identity and set of interests to the colonies, then to Britain and Parliament. But we really felt that it was important to also include the controversies over the West, particularly the way Native people were and their defense of their lands helped drive the direction of the British Empire. So at the end of the Seven Years' War in British North America, the Crown has this vastly expanded territory. And for all the promise that that offers, it also creates an incredibly increased complexity of populations and of interests and of expectations of that distant crown. And I think we were thinking the beginning gallery in particular of work like Brendan McConville's King's Three Faces, showing how because the crown was so remote, it could mean all things to all people. As early as the 1730s, enslaved people are rebelling against their enslavement and using appeals to royal authority as a grounds for doing so. Meanwhile, of course, slave owners expect the British Army to protect their plantations, their right to own other people. That is one of multiple conflicts that the Crown has to resolve, which are embedded in the perception of people across North America that the Crown is powerful and is kind of on their side. And the conflict over how to handle Western settlement, which positions settlers, English and other European descended settlers who have land claims based on their French and Indian War, their Seven Years' War service, against Native people who have been on this land for generations. That conflict is one that the Crown struggles to resolve and ends up creating this expensive British military force along the mountain ridge that becomes the Proclamation Line, 1763. And this army requires payment and food and support and supplies, and that needs to be paid for. And it's that debt, it's that ongoing maintenance that the Stamp Act is designed to help offset. So we really wanted to show from the very beginning how it's the complicated dynamics of the diverse populations of North America that really show the beginnings of the American Revolution, that really drive the transformations of the early 1760s.
You noted that the Revolution wasn't just a war, but that the war was part of the American Revolution. I'm going to take a minute here to talk about one of our sponsors, and then I wonder if you would tell us about how the museum balances telling the histories of the American Revolution and the War for Independence. This episode of Ben Franklin's World is brought to you by the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture, proud citizens of vast early America, and publishers of the OI Reader app. The OI Reader is a free app where you can explore high-resolution maps and images that you can enlarge and navigate, new and classic essays from the William & Mary Quarterly, the leading journal of early American history since 1943, and special interactive content, like the bonus materials for the Doing History series. For many episodes of the Doing History to the Revolution series, you'll find complimentary historical images, documents, and audio content to explore within the OI Reader app for free. For example, for episode 130, our episode about Paul Revere and his famous ride, you'll find an interactive first edition of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's incredibly popular poem, Paul Revere's Ride. Scholars and talented staff members at the Omohundro Institute went through and placed icons around the poem. Simply tap these icons to open up illustrations and images of the people and places discussed in the poem. Plus, you'll also find clips of audio I had to cut from the episode, such as one from our guest, Christoph Ermster, where he describes how Americans would have read the poem when it was published in the 19th century, and how you can read it today to get the most fun and information out of it. The OI Reader app is free and available for all your favorite iOS and Android devices. To download the app, visit your favorite app store and search for OI Reader, or visit benfranklinsworld.com/OIReader. Okay, so we were discussing how the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia defines the American Revolution and interprets its history. And during our discussion, Phil noted that the Revolution wasn't just a war, but that the war was part of the American Revolution. Phil, would you tell us about how the museum balances telling the histories of the American Revolution and the War for Independence?
Well, we actually use the term Revolutionary War, I think, more often in the galleries than War for Independence. And I think that's because as much as we don't see the war as coextant with the revolution, we tell a story of the war being revolutionary, of changing and transforming society, culture, of expanding and changing dynamics across the world, ultimately, as French, Spanish, and Dutch involvement increases. And then, of course, as colonial powers, their involvement spreads the combat around the world and among new people. And so we don't really separate our approach when we move into the military territory. That is, we're still trying to ask questions using the objects and visuals and figures we display about what is revolutionary, what is happening that is changing or disrupting things in this war. So that said, in some ways, with military history and with the story of war, there tend to be a lot of dramatic images and a lot of surviving objects that I think read as immediately tied to the story, immediately involved in political change or conflict. So there's many, many muskets surviving and swords surviving, and there's some textiles and headgear and things like that. I think these things tend to be preserved because war has been treated or was treated in the 19th century as a particularly important part of history to memorialize and to preserve. So often one of the challenges in dealing with the political transformations is to link for visitors what is the connection between, say, a piece of ceramic or a wool or silk stocking or a Philadelphia printed book to the familiar narrative of the revolution. With the war, there's a kind of more self-evident relationship to some of the objects we have on display. Now, that said, I also would point out that one of the things that we try to do in our telling of the war story is to really introduce visitors to different communities at war. So it's really when you get into the war proper, into the 1775-76 period through 83, that in succession you meet British soldiers as human beings, as people. They've got working lives, they've got aspirations, they have children following them in the camp. 1/6 to 1/10 of the British Army personnel were women belonging to the army, camp followers, often wives of soldiers, and they're doing hard work around the camp. They're following the army. And then you meet German and Hessian forces. You meet Native American communities at war. You meet the people from across the Atlantic world and even out to the Pacific as we learn about naval combat and privateering. You meet communities of loyalists, communities of neutrals like Quakers in Philadelphia, and you meet enslaved populations for North and South who are trying to navigate the promises made in different places at different times by both sides for their own emancipation and trying to figure out which side has the best promise and best probable route to that outcome. And so the war parts of the exhibits are really a path traveling you through the worlds of revolutionary North America and beyond.
Phil, we know that museums cost a lot of money to start and run, and that they need a lot of visitation to help support them. Did the museum conduct any research to find out whether Americans knew more about the military aspect of the revolution versus its political, economic, and social movements? And if so, how did you use this research to curate the museum's interpretation of the revolution?
We did work with some colleagues from peer institutions, museums, and academics to try to identify what their sense of the audiences they'd encountered was. We did do some market research to try to learn what topics most resonated with people. But ultimately, we felt that what was more important than those quantitative studies was trying to tell a good story. I think we all felt that good story is a good story. And if you tell it well, people will find themselves engaged. They will identify with it as basically passing the smell test as real, as complicated enough, as empathetic and somehow seeming true on some level. And I think that's what we really tried to do with our approach to the exhibits. I think rather than trying to provide people with the story they already know or what they necessarily expect or want, we try to provide sort of arresting, unexpected scenes, a sort of surprising and maybe at first confusing image of George Washington, for example, trying to wrestle his own men apart as they're fighting each other with snowballs and rocks and chunks of mud and fists as the army first comes together. And that particular scene I'm referring to, we created with life-size figures dressed in closely researched and exactly reproduced period clothing and equipment. And it's meant to make you curious. What's going on here? I mean, we may all have seen the picture of Washington crossing the Delaware or know of the victory at Yorktown or even the victory at Boston. But why is he in there pulling his troops off of each other? And in a case like that, we really are hoping that that arresting scene will encourage people to look at the objects and look at the walls around it and really find out, what is the story? What does this mean? In that case, the scene is really about a fight over what it means to be American, what this new country is going to be about in the first large community of Americans gathered together to resist the crown, the Continental Army in 1775. And when Virginians and Pennsylvanians on the one hand and New Englanders on the other first get sight of each other, they don't really necessarily like what they see. So it's that kind of, I think, surprising moment that can do the most to make the story real for people.
Yeah, I'd like for us to talk more about how you tell the stories that the museum tells. As we know, there are always many sides and many points of view to explore when we study any event or war. So what points of view on the American Revolution does the museum offer visitors? And how did you and other museum staff decide to offer those points of view and not other points of view?
Well, we really tried to strike a balance, and we really tried to show, as I say, different communities. And I think that one of the important messages is that British North America was already a very diverse place, and it was part of a complicated geography and demographics of North America and the Atlantic world and Europe already, and that we wanted that to come across as we went from story to story and community to community. But one of the challenges was we couldn't tell every story, because if we tried to, we have about 16,000 square feet in the main exhibit sequence. And if you try to tell a complete story of the American Revolution, it's too big. There's too many people to try to get into every motivation and every mind, even every community. So we tried to focus on groups that were making a critical decision about which way to go at a key moment in the war. For example, we really at one point highlight the Oneida community of the Iroquois Nation and their challenge in the summer of 1777 as they are asked by both the Congress and the King to form a military alliance. That spring and summer, the Congress and the King both sought military alliances from Native communities all over North America, and they did so at the same time because both of the sides realized after Washington's successes at Trenton and Princeton, after British General and Admiral William and Richard Howe's successes in New York, both sides realized that neither one was going to have an easy time with this war, and they needed all the alliances they could get. The fact that both sides were demanding a military alliance meant that Native people had to choose both a friend and an enemy that summer. And of course, whichever one they chose as an enemy might burn their villages, might destroy their crops, might do any number of the horrific things that had happened to Native peoples for two centuries. And in most cases, Native American groups chose to side with the British. And we tell those stories along the walls and unpack the story of the Seneca and the Cayuga, the Delaware, the Cherokee, the Creek, various groups. But we felt we needed to focus in on one community with more depth in order to make the dynamic and the problem and the danger come alive. And so we have a group of figures standing as they might in a council house or even within a village conversation, expressing different perspectives on whether or not the Oneida should join one or the other side. And some of them are saying, well, let's try to remain neutral, while others point out that's basically become impossible. One of them says the British and the colonies are like two scissors that look like they'll destroy each other, but they only destroy what's between them. And that's basically us, the Oneida. So imagery like that, the problem of the Oneida becomes, I think, more vivid. And by implication, the problem for other Native groups becomes clearer, even if most of those other groups made a different decision than the Oneida. The Oneida did end up allying with the United States. Other examples, we've been criticized, for example, for not sufficiently attending to the commanders of the battles of Saratoga. And instead, that part of the museum looks in depth at the experience of war at Saratoga on that campaign for a camp follower in the British Army, a German woman named the Baroness von Redesel, who was from Brunswick, Germany, and was married to the Baron Redesel, who was the commander of the Brunswick troops, who were attached to the British forces on that campaign. They were hired by the British to fight alongside them. These are part of the so-called Hessians. And she kept this remarkable journal of her experiences. And it is one of the most emotionally expressive accounts of the trauma of the Revolutionary War from the time, and certainly from a woman's perspective. And we felt that expressing those traumatic effects, the reality of the war on the ground, was something we hadn't sufficiently done in other areas. We dealt with motivations, and we dealt with the physical hardships, we dealt with the ideas and the ideology, we dealt with the symbols different groups used, tried to work out what they were fighting for. But the sort of interior, which you might call a psychological problem of seeing and experiencing violence, really needed more attention. And so we chose to do that with our Saratoga wall. In other words, every area has to do multiple things because we've got such tight space. And it sounds like a lot, but in the end of the day, trying to put the American Revolution into 16,000 square feet is a very difficult thing. So those decisions, all of them really took hours and hours of debate and discussion. And you could tell the story 1,000 different ways. And I hope that the galleries inspire visitors to think about how they might tell it differently, what stories they might have included. I think it would be a great exercise if schools came through and gave that assignment. What would you do differently here?
You know, it sounds like as a curator of a museum, you face a lot of the same challenges that historians face when they write books, articles, and even podcast episodes about what information to include in their projects and what information to leave out.
Yeah, I think that having worked in a written form, writing a dissertation and articles, some of the differences I notice are that, you know, when you're working in three dimensions and you're working displaying objects, you have to not only have a primary source, but the object or an object to illustrate the story you're telling. And sometimes they just don't survive. A good example is we begin the galleries with a scene from New York City where hours after the Declaration of Independence was first read in the city, a crowd gathered down in Bowling Green to tear down the statue of George III. And part of the reason we chose that scene was that pieces of that original statue still survive. So later in the exhibit, after you've had time to process and think about the meaning of that tearing down of this figure, you actually come upon real chunks of the lead with tool marks from having been ripped apart. And I think it helps reinforce the reality of those events and the violence of that moment. We had some criticism early on that, well, why aren't you doing Pennsylvanians' destruction of the wooden royal coat of arms in what became Independence Hall, which was the Pennsylvania State House? They dragged it out and burned it. Well, because they burned it, it's gone. So, you know, we're kind of limited, not just by the typical questions of what historians have over which region am I going to focus on, which particular social group or what dynamic am I interested in, but also what's left to show. And then another aspect is, because we're working in a kind of visual medium and a three-dimensional one, we have to create a vivid experience. And as a writer, you can often create a character and develop a figure through just the vividness of your words. But our visitors are moving quickly through exhibits. The statistics are that 90% of visitors only read 1% of the text, and you don't know which 1% that is, and it's likely to be a little bit here and a little bit there. So creating some really dramatic visuals is important. And in a period before photography, it can be really challenging to get people to identify with the often generic and formal paintings of the period. So that's why we created so many of these life-size figures, which then are interpreted by the cases and walls around them. And finally, it's sort of a one-room schoolhouse in that, you know, if you're writing a book, you generally pitch it to a certain grade level or audience. Our goal has to be that a content expert can come with their 4 or 5-year-old and both can enjoy it and learn something and have a good time. And so putting all that together, it is a lot like the challenge of any other sort of historical narrative or analytical work, but it has some differences as well.
Phil, what do you hope that visitors take away from their visit to the Museum of the American Revolution?
Well, I think one of the things I hope people take away is the continuities between that time and ours, that as historians, our profession is the study of change over time. That's a traditional definition of it, I suppose. But I think to see that the revolutionaries, like ourselves, were complex, often divided, conflicted both in their own thinking and across different divides, and that nevertheless, in the midst of all that, this promise emerged that, as the Declaration of Independence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal, endowed with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think that's a remarkable story. And I hope that it's not so much as a discredit of the revolutionary generation that, as one reviewer put it, we present them warts and all, but rather gives confidence to us today that we can do remarkable things too.
What was the American Revolution and how do we define it? These are old questions. Questions that date back to the founding, when the founders themselves asked, what was the American Revolution? Was it a war? Was it an event? When did it start and when did it end? Even today, with nearly 250 years of distance from the Revolution, we struggle to answer these same questions. This is why Phil and his colleagues took an expansive view of the American Revolution when they created the Museum of the American Revolution. The museum showcases many different things, like the protest movements of the 1760s and early 1770s, the war that took place between 1775 and 1783, and the political events that culminated with the creation and implementation of the Constitution of 1787. Like many scholars, the Museum of the American Revolution views the American Revolution as a long event, one that spanned between 1763 with the end of the French and Indian War to the installation of the federal government in 1789 and 1790. Now, additionally, the Museum of the American Revolution also highlights that there were many different revolutions that took place during the all-encompassing American Revolution. With physical and digital exhibits, the museum seeks to give voice to the many different experiences of the revolution. Because as individuals and groups, civilians, soldiers, sailors, women, enslaved people, Native Americans, loyalists, and British and German soldiers all experienced the American Revolution differently. And this is what makes studying the history of the American Revolution so fun and exciting. It's a huge event and period, which means there's always room for new interpretations, new focuses, and new discoveries. Plus, how we understand the revolution changes over time. We need to remember that history is about interpreting what happened in the past so that we can make sense of it in the present. Historians base their interpretations on documentary, physical, and oral evidence from the period of the past that they're studying. But no matter how hard they try to stay objective and view events like the American Revolution on their own terms, the present informs their interpretations. This is partly why what we know about history changes over time, because the circumstances in which we investigate history change over time. It really is true that the history books we love to read are often as much about the time they were written in as they are about the past people and events that they seek to tell us about. And this is why exploring the American Revolution, what we know about it, and how what we know about it has changed over time is what the Doing History to the Revolution series seeks to do. To best understand the American Revolution, we not only need to understand its history, we need to understand its histories. Look for more information about the Museum of the American Revolution, the Doing History series, and notes from our conversation on the show notes page, benfranklinsworld.com/151. I'd like to extend a big thank you to the Doing History team for all their help with this episode, and to all my colleagues who took the time to answer my questions about the revolution at the Omohundro Institute's annual conference in Ann Arbor. The historians you heard voicing their definitions of the American Revolution at the start of this episode were Norris Leninsky, Elijah Gould, Caitlin DeAngelis Hopkins, Cam Shriver, Matthew Spooner, Andrew Schockett, Lindsay Chervinsky, Marcus Nevius, Serena Zabin, and Craig Gallagher. If you'd like to hear more voices from this episode, explore the bonus content the Omohundro Institute has prepared in the OI Reader app. The OI Reader app is free and available for all your favorite iOS and Android devices. To download the app, search for the OI Reader in your favorite app store or visit benfranklinsworld.com/OIReader. Finally, how do you define the American Revolution? I'm curious what you think, so please send me your thoughts via email, liz@benfranklinsworld.com, tweet me, @LizCovart, or post a comment in our listener community on Facebook.
And remember, never leave till tomorrow that which you can do today.